She and Bobby assisted Frank off the bed and onto his feet. His legs buckled under him, and they had to support him. He complained of weakness and dizziness. Stuffing the other set of clothes in the pillowcase, Hal said, "If we have to, Bobby, I can carry him."
I'm sorry to be so much trouble," Frank said.
To Julie, he had never sounded or looked more pathetic, and she felt a flush of guilt about her reluctance to touch him. Flanking Frank, their arms around him to provide support, Julie and Bobby walked him back and forth past the rain-washed window, giving him a chance to recover the use of his legs. Gradually, his strength and balance returned.
"But my pants keep falling down," Frank said.
They propped him against the bed, and he leaned on Julie while Bobby lifted the blue cotton sweater to see if the belt needed to be cinched in one notch. The tongue end of the belt was weakened by scores of small holes, as if industrious insects had been boring at it. But what insects ate leather? When Bobby touched the tarnished brass buckle, it crumbled as though made of flaky pastry dough. Gaping at the glittering crumbs of metal on his fingers, Bobby said, "What do you shop for your clothes, Frank? In a dumpster?" In spite of Bobby's light tone, Julie knew he was unnerved. What substance or circumstances could so profoundly alter the composition of brass? When he brushed his fingers against the bed sheets to wipe off the curious residue, she flinched, half expecting his flesh to have been contaminated by the contact with the brass and to crumble, as the buckle had done. After cinching Frank's pants with the belt he had worn when he'd checked into the hospital, Hal helped Bobby slip their client out of the room. With Julie scouting the way, they went quickly and quietly along the hall and through the fire door at the head of the emergency stairs. Frank's skin remained cold to the touch, and he was still clammy with perspiration, but the effort brought a flush to his cheeks, which made him look less like a walking corpse. Julie hurried to the bottom of the stairwell to see what lay beyond the lower door. With the thump and scrape of their footsteps echoing hollowly off the bare concrete walls, the three men went down four flights without much difficulty. At the fourth floor landing, however, they had to pause to let Frank catch his breath.
"Are you always this weak when you wake up and don't remember where you've been?" Bobby asked.
Frank shook his head. His words issued in a thin wheeze.
"No, always frightened. Tired, but not as bad as this. I feel like whatever I'm doing, wherever I'm going, it's taking a bigger and bigger toll. I'm not going to survive a lot more of this."
As Frank was talking, Bobby noticed something peculiar about the man's blue cotton sweater. The pattern of the cable knit was wildly irregular in places, as if the knitting machine had briefly gone berserk. And on the back, near his right shoulder blade, a patch of fibers was missing. The hole was the size of a block of four postage stamps, though with irregular rather than straight edges, but it wasn't just a hole. A piece of what appeared to be khaki filled the gap, not merely sewn on, but woven tightly into the surrounding cotton yarn, as if at the garment factory itself. Khaki of the same shade and hard finish as the pants that Frank was wearing. A shiver of dread pierced Bobby, although he was not sure why. His subconscious mind seemed to understand how the patch had come to be and what it meant, and grasped some hideous consequences not yet fulfilled, while his conscious mind was baffled. He saw that Hal, on the other side of Frank, had noticed the patch too and was frowning. Julie ascended the stairs while Bobby was staring in puzzlement at the khaki swatch.
"We're in luck," she said. "There are two doors at the bottom. One leads into a hallway off the lobby, where we'd probably run into a security man, even though they aren't looking for Frank anymore. But the other door leads into the parking garage, the same level our car's on. How you doing, Frank? You gonna be okay?"
"Getting my second wind,"
he said less wheezily than before. "Look at this," Bobby said, calling Julie's attention to the khaki woven into the blue cotton sweater. While Julie studied the peculiar patch, Bobby let go of Frank and, on a hunch, stooped down to examine the legs of his client's pants. He found a corresponding irregularity. Blue cotton yarn from the sweater was woven into the slacks. It was not one spot of the same size and shape as that of the sweater, but a series of three smaller holes near the cuff on the right leg. However, he was sure that more accurate measurements would confirm what he knew from a quick look, that the total amount of blue yarn in those three holes would just about fill the hole in the shoulder of the sweater. "What's wrong?" Frank asked. Bobby didn't respond, but took hold of the somewhat baggy leg of the pants and pulled it taut so that he could get a better look at the three patches. Actually, patches was an inaccurate word, because these abnormalities in the fabric did not look like repairs. They were too well blended with the material around them to be handwork. Julie squatted beside him and said, "First, we've got to get Frank out of here, back to the office." "Yeah, but this is real strange," Bobby said, indicating the irregularities in the pants. "Strange and important somehow." "What's wrong?" Frank repeated. "Where'd you get these clothes?" Bobby asked.
"I don't know."
Julie pointed to the white athletic sock on Frank's right foot, and Bobby saw at once what had caught her attention. Several blue threads, precisely the color of the sweater. They were not loose, clinging to the sock. They were woven into the very fabric of it. Then he noticed Frank's left shoe. It was a dark brown hiking shoe, but a few thin, squiggly white lines marred the leather on the toe. When he studied them closely, he saw that the lines appeared to be coarse threads, like those in the athletic socks. Scraping at them with one fingernail, he discovered they were not stuck to the shoe, but were an integral part of the surface of the leather. The missing yarn of the sweater had somehow become a part of both the khaki pants and one of the socks. The displaced threads of the sock had become part of the shoe on the other foot. "What's wrong?" Frank repeated, more fearfully than before. Bobby hesitated to look up, expecting to see the filaments of displaced shoe leather were embedded in Frank's face, and that the displaced flesh was magically entwined with the cable knit of the sweater. He stood and forced himself to confront his client. Aside from the dark and puffy rings around his eyes, the sickly pallor relieved only by the flush on his upper cheeks, and the fear and confusion that gave him a tormented look, nothing was wrong with his face. No leather ornamentation, no khaki stitched into his lips, no filaments of blue yarn or plastic shoelace tips or button fragments bristling from his eyeballs. Silently castigating himself for his overactive imagination, Bobby patted Frank's shoulder. "It's okay, it's all right. We'll figure it out later. Come on, let's get you out of here."
In the embrace of darkness, enwrapped by the scent of Chanel No. 5, under the very blankets and sheets that had once warmed his mother, and that he had so carefully preserved, Candy dozed and awakened repeatedly with a start, though he could not remember any nightmares. Between periods of fitful sleep, he dwelt on the incident in the canyon earlier that night, when he had been hunting and had felt an unseen presence put a hand on his head. He'd never before experienced anything like that. He was disturbed by the encounter, unsure whether it was threatening or benign, and anxious to understand it. He first wondered if it had been his mother's angelic presence hovering above him. But he quickly dismissed that explanation. If his mother had stepped through the veil between this world and the next, he would have recognized her spirit, her singular aura of love, warmth, and compassion. He would have fallen to his knees under the weight of her ghostly hand and wept with joy at her visitation. Briefly, he had considered that one or both of his inscrutable sisters possessed a heretofore unrevealed talent for psychic contact and reached out to him for unknown reasons. After all, somehow they controlled their cats and appeared to have equal influence over other small animals. Maybe they could enter human minds as well. He didn't want that pale, cold-eyed pair invading his privacy. At times he looked at them and thought of snakes, sinuous albino snakes, silent and watchful, with desires as alien as any that motivated reptiles. The possibility that they could intrude into his mind was chilling, even if they could not control him. But between bouts of sleep, he abandoned that idea. If Violet and Verbena possessed such abilities, they would have enslaved him long ago, as thoroughly as they had enslaved the cats. They would have forced him to do degrading, obscene things. They did not possess his self-control in matters of the flesh, and would live, if they could, in constant violation of God's most fundamental commandments. He could not understand why his mother had sworn him to keep and protect them, any more than he could understand how she could love them. Of course, her compassion for those miscreant offspring was only one more example of her saintly nature. Forgiveness and understanding flowed from her like clear, cool water from an artesian well. For a while, he dozed. When he woke with a start again, he turned on his side and watched the faint light of dawn appear along the edges of the drawn blinds. He considered the possibility that the presence in the canyon had been his brother, Frank. But that was also unlikely. If Frank had possessed telepathic abilities, he would have found a way to employ them to destroy Candy a long, long time ago. Frank was less talented than his sisters, and much less talented than his brother, Candy. Then, who had approached him twice in the canyon, insistently pressing into his mind? Who sent the disconnected words that echoed in his head? What? Where? What? Why? What? Where? What? Why? Last night he'd tried to get a mental grip on the presence. When it hastily withdrew from him, he had tried to let part of his consciousness soar up into the night with it, but he had been unable to sustain the pursuit on that psychic plane. He sensed, however, that he might be able to develop that ability. If the unwelcome presence ever returned, he would try to knot a filament of his mind to it and trace it to its source. In his 29 years, his own siblings were the only people he had encountered with what might be called psychic abilities. If someone out there in the world was also gifted, he must learn who it was. Such a person, not born of his sainted mother, was a rival, a threat, an enemy. Though the sun behind the blinded windows had not fully risen, he knew that he would not be able to doze again. He threw back the covers, crossed the dark and furniture-crowded room with the assurance of a blind man in the familiar place, and went into the adjoining bath. After locking the door, he undressed without glancing in the mirror. He peed forcefully without looking down at his hateful organ. When he showered, he soaped and rinsed the sex thing only with the washcloth mitten that he'd made and that protected his innocent hand from being corrupted by the monstrous, wicked flesh below.
From the hospital in Orange, they went directly to their offices in Newport Beach. They had a lot of work to do on Frank's behalf, and his worsening plight evoked in them a greater sense of urgency than ever. Frank rode with Hal, and Julie followed, in order to be able to offer assistance if unforeseen developments occurred during the trip. The entire case seemed to be a series of unforeseen developments. By the time they reached their deserted offices, the Dakota and Dakota staff would not arrive for a couple of hours yet. The sun was fully risen behind the clouds in the east. A thin strip of blue sky, like a crack under the door of the storm, was visible over the ocean to the west. As the four of them passed through the reception lounge into the inner sanctum, the rain halted abruptly, as if a godly hand had turned a celestial lever. The water on the big window stopped flowing in shimmering sheets and coalesced into hundreds of small beads that glimmered with a mercury-gray sheen in the cloud-dulled morning light. Bobby indicated the bulging pillowcase that Hal was carrying. "Take Frank into the bathroom. Help him change into the clothes he was wearing when we checked him into the hospital. Then we'll have a real close look at the clothes he's wearing now." Frank had recovered his balance and most of his strength. He did not need Hal's assistance.
But Julie knew Bobby wouldn't let Frank go anywhere unchaperoned from now on. They needed to keep an eye on him constantly in order not to miss any clues that might lead to an explanation of his sudden vanishments and reappearances. Before attending to Frank, Hal removed the rumpled clothes from the pillowcase. He left the rest of its contents on Julie's desk. "Coffee?" Bobby said. "Desperately," she said. He went out to the pantry that opened off the lounge to start one of their two Mr. Coffee machines. Sitting at her desk, Julie emptied the pillowcase. It contained 30 bundles of $100 bills in packs bound by rubber bands. She fanned the edges of the bills in 10 bundles to ascertain if lower denominations were included. They were all hundreds. She chose two packets at random and counted them. Each contained 100 bills, 10,000 in each. By the time Bobby returned with mugs, spoons, cream, sugar, and a pot of hot coffee all on a tray, Julie had concluded that this was the largest of Frank's three hauls to date. $300K, she said, as Bobby put the tray down on the desk. He whistled softly. "What's that bring the total to?" "With this, we'll be holding $600,000 for him. Soon have to get a bigger office safe." Hal Yamataka put Frank's other set of clothes on the coffee table. "Something's wrong with the zipper in these pants. I don't mean just that it doesn't work, which it doesn't. I mean something's very wrong with it." Hal, Frank, and Julie pulled up chairs around the low, glass-topped table and drank strong black coffee while Bobby sat on the couch and carefully inspected the garments. In addition to the oddities he had noticed at the hospital, he discovered that most of the teeth in the pant zipper were metal, as they should have been, while about 40 others, interspersed at random, appeared to be hard black rubber. In fact, the slide was jammed on a couple of the rubber ones. Bobby stared in puzzlement at the anomalous zipper, slowly moving a finger up and down one of the notched tracks until he was suddenly struck by inspiration. He picked up one of the shoes Frank had been wearing and examined the heel. It looked perfectly normal. But in the heel of the second shoe, 30 or 40 tiny, brass-bright bits of metal were embedded in the rubber, flush with the surface of it. "Anybody have a penknife?" Bobby asked. Hal withdrew one from his pocket. Bobby used it to pry loose a couple of the shiny rectangles, which appeared to have been set in the rubber when it was still molten. Zipper teeth. They fell onto the glass table. Tink, tink. At a glance, he estimated that the amount of rubber displaced by those teeth was equal to what he had found in the zipper.
Sitting in the Dakota's Disney-embellished office, Frank Pollard was overwhelmed by a weariness that was cartoonish in its extremity. The degree of utter exhaustion sufficient to render Donald Duck so limp that he might slip off a chair and pour onto the floor in a puddle of mallard flesh and feathers. It had been seeping into him day by day, hour by hour, since he had awakened in that alleyway last week. But now, it suddenly poured through him as if a dike had broken. This surging flood of weariness had a density not of water but of liquid lead, and he felt enormously heavy. He could lift a foot or move a limb only with effort, and even keeping his head up was a strain on his neck. Virtually every joint in his body ached dully, even his elbow and wrist and finger joints, but especially his knees, hips, and shoulders. He felt feverish, not acutely ill, but as if his strength had been steadily sapped by a low-grade viral infection from which he had been suffering his entire life. Weariness had not dulled his senses. On the contrary, it abraded his nerve endings as surely as a fine-grade sandpaper might have done. Loud sounds made him cringe. Bright light made him squint in pain, and he was exquisitely sensitive to heat and cold and the textures of everything he touched. His exhaustion seemed only in part a result of his inability to sleep more than a couple of hours a night. If Hal Yamataka and the Dakotas could be believed, and Frank saw no reason for them to lie to him, He performed an incredible vanishing act several times during the night, though upon returning to his bed and staying put there, he could recall nothing of what he had done. Whatever the cause of those disturbances, no matter where he had gone or how or why, the very act of vanishing seemed likely to require an expenditure of energy as surely as walking or running or lifting heavy weights or any other physical act. Therefore, perhaps his weakness and profound weariness were largely the result of his mysterious night journeys. Bobby Dakota had pried only a couple of the brass teeth from the heel of the shoe. After studying them for a moment, he put down the penknife, leaned back against the sofa, and looked thoughtfully at the gloomy but rainless sky beyond the office's big windows. They were all silent, waiting to hear what he deduced from the condition of those clothes and shoes. Even exhausted, preoccupied with his own fears, and after only a one-day association with the Dakotas, Frank realized that Bobby was the more imaginative and mentally nimble of the two. Julie was probably smarter than her husband, but she was also a more methodical thinker than he was, far less likely than he was to make sudden leaps of logic to arrive at insightful deductions and imaginative solutions. Julie would more often be right than Bobby was, but on those occasions when the firm resolved a client's problems quickly, the resolution would usually be attributable to Bobby. They made a good pair, and Frank was relying on their complementary natures to save him. Turning to Frank again, Bobby said, "What if, somehow, you can teleport yourself, send yourself from here to there in a wink?" "But that's magic," Frank said. "I don't believe in magic." "Oh, I do," Bobby said. "Not witches and spells and genies and bottles, but I believe in the possibility of fantastic things. The very fact that the world exists, that we're alive, and that we can laugh and sing and feel the sun on our skin, that seems a kind of magic to me." "Teleport myself?" "If I can. I don't know I can. Evidently I have to fall asleep first. Which means teleportation must be a function of my subconscious mind, essentially involuntary." "You weren't asleep when you reappeared in the hospital room, or any of the other times you vanished," Hal said. "Maybe the first time, but not later. Your eyes were open, you spoke to me." "But I don't remember it," Frank said frustratedly. "I only remember going to sleep. And then suddenly I was lying awake in bed, in a lot of distress, confused, and you were all there." Julie sighed. "Oh, teleportation, how can that be possible?" "You saw it," Bobby shrugged. He picked up his coffee and took a sip, more relaxed than anyone in the room, as though having a client with an astonishing psychic power was, if not an ordinary occurrence, at least a situation that all of them should have realized was simply inevitable, given enough years in the private security business. "I saw him disappear," Julie agreed, "but I'm not sure that proves he teleported. When he disappeared," Bobby said, "he went somewhere, right?" "Well, yes. And going from one place to another instantaneously as an act of sheer willpower, as far as I'm concerned, that's teleportation." "But how?" Julie asked. Bobby shrugged again. "Right now, it doesn't matter how. Just accept the assumption of teleportation as a place to start." "As a theory," Hal said. "Okay," Julie agreed. "Theoretically, let's assume Frank can teleport himself." To Frank, who was sealed off from his own experience by amnesia, that was like assuming iron was lighter than air in order to allow an argument for the possibility of steel-plated blimps. But he was willing to go along with it. Bobby said, "Good, all right. Then that assumption explains the condition of these clothes." "How?" Frank asked. "It'll take a while to get to the clothes. Stay with me. First, consider that maybe teleporting yourself requires that the atoms of your body temporarily disassociate themselves from one another and then come together again an instant later. At another place. The same thing goes for the clothes you're wearing and for anything on which you've got a firm grip, like the bed railing. Like the teleportation pod in that movie, Hal said. The fly. Yeah, Bobby said, clearly getting excited now. He put down his coffee and slid forward on the edge of the sofa, gesticulating as he spoke. Yeah, sort of like that, except the power to do this is maybe all in Frank's mind, not in a futuristic machine. He just sort of thinks himself somewhere else, disassembles himself in a fraction of a second, poof, and reassembles himself at his destination. Of course, I'm also assuming the mind remains intact even during the time the body's dispersed in disconnected atoms, because it would have to be the sheer power of the mind that transports those billions of particles and keeps them together like a shepherd collie herding sheep, then welds them to one another again in the right configurations at the far end. Though his weariness was sufficient to have resulted from an impossibly complex and strenuous task, like the one Bobby had just described, Frank was unconvinced. Well, gee, I don't know. This isn't something you go to school to learn. UCLA doesn't have a course in teleportation, so it's instinct? Even supposing I instinctively know how to break my body down into a stream of atomic particles and send it somewhere else, then put it together again, how can any human mind, even the greatest genius ever born, be powerful enough to keep track of those billions of particles and get them all back exactly as they belong? It'd take 100 geniuses, 1,000, and I'm not even one. I'm no dummy, but I'm no brighter than the average guy. You've answered your own question, Bobby said. You don't need superhuman intelligence for this, because teleportation isn't primarily a function of intelligence. It's not instinct either. It's just, well, an ability programmed into your genes like vision or hearing or the sense of smell. Think of it this way. Any scene you look at is composed of billions of separate points of color and light and shade and texture. Yet your eyes instantly order those billions of bits of input into a coherent scene. You don't have to think about seeing. You just see. It's automatic. You understand what I mean about magic? Vision is almost magical. With teleportation, there's probably a trigger mechanism you have to pull, like wishing yourself to be elsewhere, but thereafter, the process is pretty much automatic. The mind makes it happen the way it makes instantaneous sense of all the data coming in through your eyes. Frank closed his eyes tight and concentrated on wishing himself into the reception lounge. When he opened his eyes and was still in the inner office, he said, "It doesn't work. It's not that easy. I can't do it at will," Hal said. "Bobby, are you saying all of us have this ability, and only Frank has figured out how to use it?" No, this is probably a scrap of genetic material unique to Frank. Maybe even a talent that sprung from genetic damage." They were all silent, absorbing what Bobby had conjectured. Outside, the layer of clouds was cracking, peeling, and the old blue paint of the sky was showing through in more places every minute. But the brightening day did not lift Frank's spirits. Finally, Hal Yamataka indicated the pile of garments on the coffee table. "How does all this explain the condition of those clothes?" Bobby picked up the blue cotton sweater and held it so they could see the khaki swatch on the back. "Okay, let's suppose the mind can automatically shepherd all the molecules of its own body through the teleportation process without a single error. It can also deal with other things Frank wants to take with him, like his clothes and bags full of money," Julie said. "But why the bed railing?" Hal asked. "No reason for him to want to take that with him." "To Frank," Bobby said. "You can't remember it now, but you clearly knew what was happening while you were caught up in that series of teleportations. You were trying to stop. You asked Hal to help you stop, and you seized the railing to stop yourself. to anchor yourself to the hospital room. You were concentrating on your grip on that railing. So when you went, you took it with you. As for the clothes getting scrambled the way they are, maybe your mind concentrates first on getting your body back together in the proper order, because error-free physical recreation is crucial to your survival. But then, sometimes you might not have the energy left to do as good a job on secondary things, like clothes. Well, Frank said, I can't remember prior to last week, but this is the first time anything like this has happened since then, even though I've apparently been traveling more nights than not. Then again, even if my clothes have come through okay, I seem to be getting more weary, weaker, and more confused day by day. He did not have to finish the thought, because the worry in their eyes and faces made clear their understanding. If he was teleporting, and if it was a strenuous act that bled him of strength that could not be restored by rest, he was gradually going to get less meticulous about the reconstitution of his clothes and whatever other items he tried to carry with him. But, more important, he might begin to have difficulty reconstituting his body as well. He might return from one of his late-night rambles and find fragments of his sweater woven into the back of his hand, and the skin replaced by that cotton might turn up as a pale patch in the dark leather of his shoe. And the displaced leather from the shoe might appear as an integral part of his tongue, or as strands of alien cells twisted through his brain tissue. Fear, never far away, and circling like a shark in the depths of Frank's mind, abruptly shot to the surface, called forth by the worry and pity that he saw in the faces of those on whom he was depending for salvation. He closed his eyes, but that was a rotten idea, because he had a vision of his own face when he shut out theirs. His face as it might look after a disastrous reconstitution at the end of a future telekinetic journey. 8 or 9 misplaced teeth sprouting from his right eye socket. The evicted eye staring lidlessly from the middle of the cheek below. His nose smeared in hideous lumps of flesh and gristle across the side of his face. In the vision, he opened his misshapen mouth, perhaps to scream, and within were 2 fingers and a portion of his hand, rooted where the tongue should have been. He opened his eyes as a low cry of terror and misery escaped him. He was shuddering. He couldn't stop.
Having freshened everyone's coffee, and at Bobby's suggestion having laced Frank's mug with bourbon in spite of the early hour, Hal went to the nook off the reception lounge to brew another pot. After Frank had been fortified with a few sips of the spiked coffee, Julie showed the photograph to him and watched his reaction carefully. You recognize either of these people in this? No. No, they're strangers to me. The man, Bobby said, is George Ferris, the real George Ferris. We got the picture from his brother-in-law. Frank studied the photograph with renewed interest. Maybe I knew him, and that's why I borrowed his name. But I can't recall ever seeing him before. He's dead, Julie said, and thought that Frank's surprise was genuine. She explained how Ferris had died years ago, and then how his family had been slaughtered far more recently. She told him about James Roman, too, and how Roman's family died in a fire in November. With what appeared to be sincere dismay and confusion, Frank said, Why all these deaths? Is it coincidence? Julie leaned forward. We think Mr. Blue killed them. Who? Mr. Blue Light. The man you said pursued you that night in Anaheim, the man you think is hunting you for some reason. We believe he discovered you were traveling under the names Ferris and Roman, so he went to the addresses he got for them, and when he didn't find you there, he killed everyone, either while trying to squeeze information out of them or just for the hell of it.
Frank looked stricken. His pale face grew even paler, as if it were an image doing a slow fade on a movie screen. The bleak look in his eyes intensified. If I hadn't been using that fake ID, he never would have gone to those people. It's because of me they died. Feeling sorry for the guy, ashamed of the suspicion that had driven her to approach the issue in this matter, Julie said, "Don't let it eat you, Frank. Most likely the paper artist who forged your documents took the names at random from a list of recent deaths. If he'd used another approach, the Ferris and Roman families would never have come to Mr. Blue's attention. It's not your fault the forger used the quick and lazy method." Frank shook his head, tried to speak, could not. "You can't blame yourself," Hal said from the doorway, where he had evidently been standing long enough to have gotten a gist of the photo's importance. He seemed genuinely distressed to see Frank so anguished. Like Clint, Hal had been won over by Frank's gentle voice, self-effacing manner, and cherubic demeanor. Frank cleared his throat, and finally the words broke loose. "No, no. It's on me. My God, all those people dead because of me." In Dakota and Dakota's computer center, Bobby and Frank sat in two spring-backed typist chairs with rubber wheels, and Bobby switched on one of the three state-of-the-art IBM PCs, each of which was outlinked to the world through its own modem and phone line. Though bright enough to work by, the overhead lights were soft and diffuse to prevent glare on the terminal screens, and the room's one window was covered with blackout drapes for the same reason. Like policemen in the Silicon Age, modern private detectives and security consultants relied on the computer to make their work easier and to compile a breadth and depth of information that could never be acquired by the old-fashioned gumshoe methods of Sam Spade and Philip Marlowe. Pounding the pavement, interviewing witnesses and potential suspects, and conducting surveillances were still aspects of their job, of course, but without the computer, they would be as ineffective as a blacksmith trying to fix a flat tire with a hammer, an anvil, and other tools of his trade. As the 20th century progressed through its last decade, private investigators who were ignorant of the microchip revolution existed only in television dramas and the curiously dated world of most PI novels. Lee Chin, who had designed and now operated their electronic data-gathering system, would not arrive at the office until around 9 o'clock. Bobby did not want to wait nearly an hour to start putting the computer to work on Frank's case. He was not a primo hacker, as Lee was, but he knew all the hardware, had the ability to learn new software quickly when he needed to, and was almost as comfortable tracking down information in cyberspace as he was poring through files of age-yellowed newspapers. Using Lee's codebook, which he removed from a locked desk drawer, Bobby first entered a Social Security Administration data network that contained files to which broad public access was legal. Other files in the same system were restricted and supposedly inaccessible behind walls of security codes required by various right-to-privacy laws. From the open files, he inquired as to the number of men named Frank Pollard in the administration's records, and within seconds, the response appeared on the screen, counting variations of Frank, such as Franklin and Frankie and Franco, plus names like Francis, for which Frank might be a diminutive. There were 609 Frank Pollards in possession of Social Security numbers. "Bobby," Frank said anxiously, "does that stuff on the screen make sense to you? Are those words real words or jumbled letters, huh? Of course they're words." "Not to me. They don't look like anything to me. Gibberish." Bobby picked up a copy of Byte magazine that was lying between two of the computers, opened it to an article, and said, "Read that." Frank accepted the magazine, stared at it, flipped ahead a couple of pages, then a couple more. His hands began to shake. The magazine rattled in his grip. "I can't. Jesus, I've lost that too. Yesterday I lost the ability to do math, and now I can't read anymore. I get more confused, foggy in the head, and I ache in every joint, every muscle. This teleporting's wearing me down, killing me. I'm falling apart, Bobby, mentally and physically, faster all the time.
It's going to be all right, Bobby said, though his confidence was largely feigned. He was pretty sure they would get to the bottom of this, would learn who Frank was and where he went at night and how and why. However, he could see that Frank was declining fast, and he would not have bet money that they'd find all of the answers while Frank was still alive, sane, and able to benefit from their discoveries. Nevertheless, he put his hand on Frank's shoulder and gave it a gentle, reassuring squeeze. Hang in there, buddy. Everything's going to be okay. I really think it is. I really do. Frank took a deep breath and nodded. Turning to the display terminal again, feeling guilty about the lie he'd just told, Bobby said, "You remember how old you are, Frank?"
"No."
"You look about 32, 33.
"I feel older."
Softly whistling Duke Ellington's Satin Doll, Bobby thought a moment, then asked the SSA computer to eliminate those Frank Pollards younger than 28 and older than 38. That left 72 of them. "Frank, do you think you've ever lived anywhere else, or are you a dyed-in-the-wool Californian?"
"I don't know."
"Let's assume you're a son of the Sunshine State." He asked the SSA computer to whittle down the remaining Frank Pollards to those who applied for their Social Security numbers while living in California, 15. Then to those whose current addresses were on file in California, 6. The public access portion of the Social Security Administration's data network was forbidden by law to reveal Social Security numbers to casual researchers. Bobby referred to instructions in Lee Chen's codebook and entered the restricted files through a complicated series of maneuvers that circumvented SSA security. He was unhappy about breaking the law, but it was a fact of high-tech life that you never got the maximum benefit from your data-gathering system if you played strictly by the rules. Computers were instruments of freedom, and governments were, to one degree or another, instruments of repression. The two could not always exist in harmony. He obtained the 6 numbers and addresses for the Frank Pollards living in California. "Now what?" Frank wondered.
"Now," Bobby said, "I use these numbers and addresses to cross-reference with the California Department of Motor Vehicles, all of the armed forces, state police, major city police, and other government agencies to get descriptions of these 6 Frank Pollards. As we learn their height, weight, hair color, color of their eyes, race, we'll gradually eliminate them one by one. Better yet, if one of them is you, and if you've ever served in the military or been arrested for a crime, we might even be able to turn up a picture of you in one of those files and confirm your identity with a photo match."
Sitting at the desk, catter-corner from each other, Julie and Hal removed the rubber bands from more than half of the packets of cash. They sorted through the $100 bills, trying to determine if some of them had consecutive serial numbers that might indicate they were stolen from a bank, savings and loan, or other institution. Suddenly, Hal looked up and said, "Why do those flute-like sounds and drafts precede Frank when he teleports himself?" "Who knows?" Julie said. "Maybe it's displaced air, following him down some tunnel in another dimension, from the place he left to the place he's going."
"I was just thinking, if this Mr. Blue's real, and if he's searching for Frank, and if Frank heard those flutes and felt those gusts in the alleyway, then Mr. Blue is also able to teleport."
"Yeah."
"So?"
"So, Frank's not unique. Whatever he is, there's another one like him. Maybe even more than one."
"Well, here's something else to think about," Julie said. "If Mr. Blue can teleport himself, and if he finds out where Frank is, we won't be able to defend a hiding place from him. He'll be able to pop up among us. And what if he arrived with a submachine gun, spraying bullets as he materialized?"
After a moment of silence, Hal said, "You know, gardening has always seemed like a pleasant profession. You need a lawnmower, a weed whacker, and a few simple tools. There's not much overhead, and you hardly ever get shot at."
Bobby followed Frank into the office, where Julie and Hal were examining the money. Putting a sheet of paper on the desk, he said, "Move over, Sherlock Holmes. The world now has a greater detective." Julie angled the page so she and Hal could read it together. It was a laser-printed copy of the information that Frank had filed with the California Department of Motor Vehicles when he had last applied for an extension of his driver's license. "The physical statistics match," she said. "Is your first name really Francis, and your middle name Ezekiel?" Frank nodded. "I didn't remember until I saw it, but it's me all right, Ezekiel." Tapping the printout, she said, "This address is El Encanto Heights. Does that ring a bell?" "No, I can't even tell you where El Encanto is." "Well, it's adjacent to Santa Barbara," Julie said. "So Bobby tells me, but I don't remember being there, except..." "What?" Frank went to the window and looked out toward the distant sea, above which the sky was now entirely blue. A few early gulls swooped in arcs so huge and smoothly described that their exuberance was thrilling to watch. Clearly, Frank was neither thrilled by the birds nor charmed by the view. Finally, still facing the window, he said, "I don't recall being in El Encanto Heights, except that every time I hear the name, my stomach sort of sinks. You know, like I'm on a roller coaster that's just taken a plunge. And when I try to think about El Encanto, strain to remember it, my heart pounds and my mouth goes dry. And it's a little harder to get my breath, so I think I must be repressing any memories I have of the place because, well, maybe because something happened to me there, something bad, something I'm too scared to remember." Bobby said his driver's license expired 7 years ago, and according to DMV records, he never tried to renew it. In fact, sometime this year, he'd have been weeded out of even their dead files, so we were lucky to find this before they expunged it. He laid two more printouts on the desk, "Move Over Holmes" and "Sam Spade." "What are these?" "Arrest reports. Frank was stopped for traffic violations once in San Francisco a little more than 6 years ago. The second time was on Highway 101 north of Ventura 5 years ago. He didn't have a valid driver's license either time, and because of odd behavior, was taken into custody." The photographs that were part of both arrest records showed a slightly younger, even pudgier man who was without a doubt their current client. Bobby pushed aside some of the money and sat on the edge of her desk. "He escaped from jail both times, so they're looking for him, even after all these years, though probably not too hard, since he wasn't arrested for a major crime." Frank said, "I draw a blank on that, too." "Neither report indicates how he escaped," Bobby said, "but I suspect he didn't saw his way through the bars, or dig a tunnel, or whittle a gun out of a bar of soap, or use any of the long-accepted traditional methods of jailbreak. Oh, no, not our Frank." "He teleported," Hal guessed. "Vanished when no one was looking." "I'd bet on it," Bobby agreed. "And after that, he began to carry false ID good enough to satisfy any cop who pulled him over." Looking at the papers before her, Julie said, "Well, Frank, at least we know this is your real name, and we've nailed down a real address for you up there in Santa Barbara County, not just another motel room. We're beginning to make headway." Bobby said, "Move over Holmes, Spade, and Miss Marple." Unable to embrace their optimism, Frank returned to the chair in which he'd been sitting earlier. "Headway, but not enough and not fast enough." He leaned forward with his arms on his thighs, hands clasped between his spread knees, and stared morosely at the floor. "Something unpleasant just occurred to me. What if I'm not only making mistakes with my clothes when I reconstitute myself? What if I've already begun to make mistakes with my own biology, too? Nothing major, nothing visible. Hundreds or thousands of tiny mistakes on a cellular level. That would explain why I feel so lousy, so tired and sore. And if my brain tissue isn't coming back together right, that would explain why I'm confused, fuzzy-headed, unable to read or do math. Julie looked at Hal, at Bobby, and knew that both men wanted to allay Frank's fear, but were unable to do so because the scenario that he had outlined was not only possible, but likely. Frank said, "The brass buckle looked perfectly normal, until Bobby touched it. Then it turned to dust." All night long, when sleep made Thomas's head empty, ugly dreams filled it. Dreams of eating small live things, dreams of drinking blood, dreams of being the bad thing. He finished sleeping all of a sudden, sitting up in bed, trying to scream, but unable to find any sounds for himself. For a while he sat there, shaking, being afraid, breathing so hard and fast, his chest ached. The sun was back. The night was gone away, and that made him feel better. Getting out of bed, he stepped into his slippers. His pajamas were cold with sweat. He shivered. He pulled on a robe. He went to the window, looked out and up, liking the blue sky very much. Leftover rain made the green lawn look soggy, the sidewalks darker than usual, and the dirt in the flower beds almost black, and in the puddles you could see the blue sky again, like a face in a mirror. He liked all of that, too, because the whole world looked clean and new after all the rain emptied out of the sky. He wondered if the bad thing was still far away or closer, but he didn't reach out to it, because last night it tried to hold him, because it was so strong he almost couldn't get away from it, and because even when he did get away, it tried to follow him. He felt it hanging on, coming back across the night with him, and he'd shaken it off real quick-like, but maybe next time he wouldn't be so lucky, and maybe it would come all the way right into his room with him, not just its mind, but the bad thing itself. He didn't understand how that could happen, but somehow he knew it might, and if the bad thing came to the home, being awake would be like being asleep with a nightmare filling up your head. Terrible things would happen, and there would be no hope. Turning away from the window, starting toward the closed door to the bathroom, Thomas glanced at Derek's bed and saw Derek dead. He was on his back. His face was bashed, bruised, swollen. His eyes were open big. You could see them shine in the light from the window and the low light from the lamp beside the bed. His mouth was open, too, like he was shouting, but all the sound was out of him, like air out of a popped balloon. And he would not have any more sound in him ever again, you could tell. Blood was let out of him, too, lots of it, and a pair of scissors was stuck in his belly, deep in, with not much more than the handles showing. The same scissors Thomas used to clip pictures from magazines for his poems. He felt a big twist of pain in his heart, like maybe somebody was sticking scissors in him too, but it wasn't hurt pain, so much as what he called feel pain, because it was losing Derek that he was feeling, not real hurt. It was as bad as real hurt, though, because Derek was his friend. He liked Derek. He was scared, too, because he somehow knew the bad thing had let the life out of Derek. The bad thing was here at the home. Then he realized this could happen just the way things sometimes happen in TV stories, with the cops coming and believing that Thomas killed Derek, blaming Thomas and everyone hating Thomas for what he'd done. But he hadn't done it, and all the while the bad thing was still loose to do more killing, maybe even doing to Julie what it had done to Derek. The hurt, the fear for himself, the fear for Julie, was too much. Thomas gripped the footboard of his own bed and closed his eyes and tried to get air into himself. It wouldn't come. His chest was tight. Then the air came in, and so did an ugly, nasty smell,
which in a while he realized was the stink of Derek's blood, so he gagged and almost puked. He knew he had to get control of himself. The aides didn't like it when you lost control of yourself, so they gave you something for your own good. He'd never lost control before and didn't want to lose it now. He tried not to smell the blood, took long deep breaths, made himself open his eyes to look at the dead body. He figured looking at it the second time wouldn't be as bad as the first. He knew it was going to be there this time, so it wouldn't be such a big surprise. The surprise was, the body was gone. Thomas closed his eyes, put one hand to his face, looked again between spread fingers. The body still wasn't there. He started shaking, because what he thought first was that this was like some other TV stories he'd seen where nasty dead bodies were walking around like live bodies, rotting and getting wormy, with bones showing in places, killing people for no reason, and even sometimes eating them. He could never watch much of one of those stories. He sure didn't want to be in one. He was so scared he almost TV'd to Bobby. Dead people, look out, look out. Dead people hungry and mean and walking around, but stopped himself when he saw there wasn't blood on Derek's blankets and sheets. The bed wasn't rumpled either, neatly made. No walking dead person was quick enough to get out of bed, change sheets and blankets, make everything right just in a few seconds while Thomas's eyes were closed. Then he heard the shower pouring down on the floor of the stall in the bathroom, and he heard Derek singing soft, the way he always did when he washed himself. For just a moment in his head, Thomas had a picture of a dead person taking a shower, trying to be neat, but rotten chunks were falling off with the dirt, showing more bones, clogging the drain. Then he realized Derek was never really dead. Thomas hadn't really seen a body on the bed. What he'd seen was something else he'd learned from TV stories. He'd seen a vision, a sidekick vision. He was a sidekick. Derek hadn't been killed. What Thomas saw just for a moment was Derek being dead tomorrow, or some other day after tomorrow. It might be something that would happen no matter what Thomas did to stop it, or it might be something that would happen only if he let it happen, but at least it wasn't something that had already happened. He let go of the footboard and went to his work table. His legs were shaky. He was glad to sit down. He opened the top drawer of the cabinet that stood beside the table. He saw his scissors in there, where they should be, with his colored pencils and pens and paper clips and scotch tape and stapler, and a half-eaten Hershey's bar in an open drawer, which shouldn't be in there because it would draw bugs. He took the candy out of the drawer and stuffed it in a pocket of his robe, reminding himself to put it in the refrigerator later. For a while, he stared at the scissors, listened to Derek sing in the shower, and thought how the scissors were jammed in Derek's belly, letting all the music and other sounds out of him forever, sending him to the bad place. Finally, he touched the black plastic handles. They felt all right. So he touched the metal blades. But that was bad. Real bad. As if leftover lightning from a storm was in the blades and jumped into him when he touched them. Sizzling, cracking, white light flashed through him. He snatched his hand back. His fingers tingled. He closed the drawer and hurried back to the bed, where he sat with the covers pulled around his shoulders the way TV Indians wrapped themselves in blankets when they sat at TV campfires. The shower stopped. So did the singing. After a while, Derek came out of the bathroom, followed by a cloud of damp, soapy, smelling air. He was dressed for the day. His wet hair was combed back from his forehead. He was not a rotting, dead person. He was all alive, every part of him, at least every part you could see, and no bones poked out anywhere. "Good morning," Derek said, his words slurred and muffled by his crooked mouth and too big tongue. He smiled. "Good morning. You sleep good?" "Yeah," Thomas said. "Breakfast soon?" "Yeah. Maybe sticky buns." "Maybe." "I like sticky buns." "Derek?" "Huh?" "If I ever tell you..." Derek waited, smiling.